Is CT resulting in too much diagnosis of lung cancer?
Overtreating patients with diabetes.
What does your genotype have to do with blood thinning medications?
How to manage lipids in patients that have kidney disease.
That's what we're talking about this week on PodMed, the weekly look at the medical headlines from Johns Hopkins, posted on December 13th, 2013. I'm Elizabeth Tracy.
And I'm Rick Lang, professor of medicine at Johns Hopkins and vice chairman of medicine at the University of Texas in San Antonio.
Rick, I think we should go right to the Journal of the American Medical Association and talk about this issue of, wow, are we seeing too many diagnoses of lung cancer relative to CT screening? This, of course, we hailed as a great advance a few years ago when the results of a very large trial utilizing this technique came out. But now, oops, what are we finding out?
Well, this trial was the National Lung Screening Trial. What are the risks of risk screening? The potential for overdiagnosis, making a diagnosis of a cancer that would never become clinically relevant. And you say, well, gosh, what's the harm of that? If you detect a lung cancer that would otherwise be inconsequential, there are obviously psychological harms to the patient, and there's the risk that there'll be additional invasive procedures and even treatment that the patient wouldn't need. So these authors attempted to address that issue of looking at overdiagnosis. Again, they used the same data from the National Lung Screening Trial. This is over 53,000 patients. What they discovered is that more than 18% of all lung cancers detected seem to be indolent and therefore considered to be an overdiagnosis. What this points out is that we need additional or better techniques for deciding whether a finding is going to actually be clinically relevant in the future. For example, things like biomarkers or better ways of imaging to determine whether something's indolent or not. What this study points out is that there's still a potential risk, and specifically for bronchoalveolar carcinoma, a particular type, the overdiagnosis rate was 80%.
Okay, all of this, of course, to me begs the question of the natural history of lung tumors, which we do not really understand. And I would probably put forward the hypothesis that there's lots of natural history of lots of different types of tumors we don't really understand. So if I were going to design the holy grail for lung cancer, it would be a way to discern which are the dangerous cancers and which are not.
And I would agree with that, by the way. And I think this study points that out as well.
So for right now, I guess if you're a cigarette or a former cigarette smoker with 30 pack years of the habit behind you, should you be screened?
I think the answer to that is yes. You need a physician or a group of individuals that know what to do with that data, specifically for the bronchoalveolar carcinomas that would otherwise be indolent.
Okay, let's turn then to the New England Journal of Medicine. This analysis, this genotype analysis of people who are going to be on the blood thinner Coumadin or warfarin, and how does that inform us?
Coumadin is a very effective blood thinner, but it's notoriously difficult to dose that drug. And for this reason and others, it makes it particularly attractive to look at dosing based upon genetic factors. And two of the biggest genetic factors are how quickly Coumadin is metabolized or whether the target is resistant to the effects of Coumadin. And there are two different genotypes that look at what's called the CYP2C9 gene or the VCOR-C1 gene that can affect patient variability. Based upon this information, it was thought that if we could use this genetic information, we could do a better job of dosing Coumadin. There are three different studies in the New England Journal of Medicine, and I'm going to summarize all three studies. In essence, they show that despite the promise, it actually doesn't pan out. The addition of genetic factors did not improve dosing of Coumadin.
Well, this is really, of course, quite disappointing because we always loved this idea that somehow we can get to the blueprint and therefore be able to say this is what it looks like clinically. So that is disappointing, I guess, in some respects. In others, it tells us that, and we knew this already too, that this whole clotting cascade is a good deal more complex and it's got lots of checks and balances than we've really been able to discern so far.
It is. For this reason, there are several different clinical factors that affect Coumadin dosing. Someone's age, their race, how big they are, whether they have diabetes or previous stroke, whether they're on other medications. So when you take all that into account, then the addition of genetics didn't add a whole lot more. The other thing it points out is that despite the promise, it really is important to do clinical trials that assess whether what we see at the bench actually makes any difference at the bedside.
Very good. Let's turn back then to the Journal of the American Medical Association and take a look at what turns out to be a pretty important public health issue. That's the risk of hypoglycemia or low blood sugar in folks with diabetes.
So So, Elizabeth, you say that this is an important health issue. Elaborate on that.
It's risky, of course. When people with diabetes are being treated, they can have their blood sugar fall to levels that are so low that they put them at tremendous risk.
And specifically, the risk is of having a stroke or cardiovascular disease or death.
Or death, exactly. Pretty hard endpoints there.
And in fact, the studies that looked at tight glucose control, those studies showed that there was an increased risk of hypoglycemia and an excess of cardiovascular death and morbidity. So you take that information, you say, okay, we don't want to have it too tight. We don't want to have it too loose. We want to try to find what that sweet range is. So what this study did was it looked at almost 750,000 veterans to identify those that were considered to be at high risk. And that was over 430,000 individuals. And they looked to see how tightly their hemoglobin A1C was controlled. Because we know, and what they discovered was that about 40% of individuals already at risk for developing hypoglycemia had a hemoglobin A1C that was lower than what's recommended. That is, they were at risk for hypoglycemia.
How much lower?
If you use the cutoff of being less than 7, about 50%. If you look at the cutoff of less than 6.5, it was about 30%. And if you look at the cutoff of less than 6, it was about 10%. Because remember that we're trying to prevent complications for diabetes that take 10 or 20 years to occur. So when someone's age 75 already, controlling their glucose too tightly doesn't give them any benefit and obviously subjects them to the risk or the harms associated with hypoglycemia. The major thrust of this article is it talks about just the opposite of what we're usually describing. That is, we're trying to implement some new therapy. Now we're trying to de-implement tight glucose control in a population that's at risk for hypoglycemia.
Another thing that occurs to me, of course, in this population and has also become much more apparent over time is that as people age, their physiology changes. And just as I suggested before, we don't really understand the natural history of lung tumors, nor do we really understand what happens to folks with regard to blood sugar as they age, irrespective of whether they have diabetes.
No, but in that same journal, there's a study called Diabetes and Aging, and we know that as people age, they're at an increased risk for developing the complications of diabetes, but also at a much more increased risk of developing hypoglycemia as well. So the recommendations are for the older individuals, loosen up a bit with regard to glucose control.
Chill out. We've heard that too with folks in the ICU, where we had some really pretty pathetic results when we tried to control things too closely. Let's turn then to talking about control. Annals of Internal Medicine. What about lipid management, our faves, those triglycerides and different types of cholesterol in people who have chronic kidney disease?
This follows up to the recently released cholesterol prevention guidelines. And this is a practice guideline issued by the Kidney Disease Improving Global Outcomes Organization that looked at all the data to come up with recommendations for assessing or treating patients with kidney disease with regard to their cholesterol. Now I'm going to summarize. If someone has chronic kidney disease, glomerular filtration rate of less than 60 for our clinicians, and they're over the age of 50, the recommendation is to put them on statins regardless of what their LDL cholesterol measurement is. Does that mean don't measure the lipids? No, they recommend measuring the lipids to see if there are some secondary causes why they might be elevated. But once that's been done to screen for secondary causes, they don't recommend repeating an LDL cholesterol measurement. And the reason for that is, regardless of what their LDL cholesterol is, they're at very high risk for having cardiovascular disease, and that risk is lowered with a statin, regardless of what their LDL cholesterol is.
I think the idea that we're somehow going to wean ourselves off of quantitative data to establish the reduction of risk is going to be interesting to watch.
We talked about de-implementing before, and that is unlearning what we've been taught. That's going to be the most difficult thing here. And what about people under the age of 50 that have chronic kidney disease? Well, they should be on a statin if they already have known coronary artery disease, diabetes, previous ischemic stroke, or their 10-year risk of developing cardiovascular disease is over 10%. With regard to people that are already on dialysis, there's no evidence that putting them on a statin lowers their cardiovascular risk. So that's not recommended.
Well, I think that's probably good news for folks on dialysis, since they have plenty of other stuff to worry about, and it's probably great not to have to worry about taking a statin.
And those individuals, drug-drug interactions are very important because they're not cleared by the kidney. And finally, the last thing is in adult kidney transplant patients, they are also recommended to have a statin, regardless of what their LDL cholesterol measurement is.
So that's bad news for people who've had transplants because, of course, they're already on a multitude of other stuff.
They are, but the risk of having cardiovascular disease, their 10-year risk of having death or a heart attack is about 20%. That's why it's important to try to lower that risk with a statin.
Okay, I'm going to sum all this up by saying it sounds like a lot of things that this week were taken away, which is maybe not such a bad thing. And on that note, I'm going to reveal that I'm going to talk about the overdiagnosis of lung cancer in the Journal of the American Medical Association on the blog. That's a look at this week's medical headlines from Johns Hopkins. I'm Elizabeth Tracy.
And I'm Rick Lyon. Y'all live well.